I'm back in the office of Graham Pike. I had to very quickly look at one of his pride and joy certificates on the wall to remember his name, because he's got intense eyes as he reaches deep into the back of your mind. And he's also very interesting. Statement of participation. You are proud of that certificate above your PhD, you told me earlier on.
I'm very proud of that certificate. It means I can sit on examination and assessment boards for university, which is one of the things I love about this job, is any interaction with the students, even if it's at a distance on an exam board.
Fantastic. And of course, this means you can do it legally. Everybody's suing everybody nowadays, it seems. In fact, your job title today is slightly different to the last job title I gave you, which was your real job title, because of some government law that came out, which to a certain extent is protecting the public. Am I right?
That's right. Yeah, I guess I misspoke last time. I actually referred to myself as a forensic psychologist. The Health Practitioners Council of the government protects certain terms, and one of those is forensic psychologist, another one is clinical psychologist. That's to stop anyone just setting themselves up in practice and taking on clients when they've got no qualifications or training. So to call yourself a forensic psychologist, you actually need to be on have a practicing certificate in forensic psychology, which I don't, and I don't have a practicing certificate because I'm an academic, so I conduct research. So I don't actually work with patients or clients. Mm-hmm. I conduct research, so I don't need one.
So as you're conducting research and paving the way, does that make you better than a practitioner?
It absolutely doesn't, no. No, lots of practitioners or people working with clients will do research as well. It's really just an emphasis. So I conduct research with the police, so I look at trying to improve the way that police investigations are conducted, and I do a lot of teaching. It's broadly in psychology, teaching broad psychological theory, but also in the area of forensic psychology, telling people about eyewitness testimony and memory, for example.
There was an amazing article I read just this week about the origins of criminal psychology. How is that related to what you do?
Well, forensic psychology very broadly can be divided into, say, four different broad areas. The first of which would be why people commit crime and how they commit crime. And a lot of criminological theory is to do with that, explaining the societal and economic pressures that might cause someone to commit a crime. In psychology, psychologists will look at personality variables and even genetic and biological variables that might give someone a predisposition to commit crime. To be honest, that's not my area of research, and it's not something I have a lot of faith in. Crime is a term that's defined differently according to points in history, differently by different societies. So I'm not too sure how, you know, if this is defined by society, how you can have a biological cause. But yeah, psychologists certainly do look at why people commit crime, which that's the link. And the other areas are really to do with police investigation. So once someone's committed a crime, how do police investigate it? The next area is to do with the courtroom. Once the police have found someone, how do you prosecute them and try them? And the final area, and perhaps the largest in forensic psychology, is once they've been convicted, how do you try to rehabilitate them?
Fascinating. You were involved in a TV programme recently. Tell me about that.
I was. It was a three-part series on BBC Two called Eyewitness. What we did with the help of the Greater Manchester Police was to stage very realistic crimes in front of a group of 10 eyewitnesses. And then essentially what we did was call the Greater Manchester Police, who came along and investigated it just if it was a real crime. The first crime was a murder in a pub. And we put hidden cameras all around the pub so that you could get a witness eye view of what happened. We then followed the police investigation so you could see how the memory of the eyewitnesses could differ from what actually took place in the crime, and how the police tried to get the most out of their memories.
Wow, is this online to view now? Sounds really good.
It is on iPlayer. There's a three-part series. The first one looks at a murder in a pub. The second one looks at a heist from a security van. We also had some technology there, which was on trial for the first time, which involved eye tracker glasses. So some of the witnesses were wearing glasses that tracked exactly what they were looking at. So we could then see the footage again and compare what they said they were looking at to what they actually were, and which was very revealing. One person said they never, throughout the crime, looked at the people committing it once. But if you go and actually look at what they were looking at, they looked at the criminals the entire time through. They just had no memory of doing so. The third in the series, we actually go and talk to some real eyewitnesses to criminal events, one of whom mistakenly identified a rapist who was put away for more than 10 years. and another one who was kidnapped, and the police were able to use a technique called a cognitive interview for one of the first times in this country and get some very small details that allowed them to find the person who kidnapped her.
How does cognitive interviewing work?
Cognitive interview is an interviewing technique based on our knowledge of how memory works. There are a series of mnemonics. A mnemonic is something that helps you remember. There's a series of mnemonic techniques that are used in the interview. The first one, perhaps the most important, is that the person is asked to recall everything, and the police officer who's conducting the interview doesn't interrupt them. What you find is, as you remember one thing, it will spur your memory to remember another thing, which will lead you to remember another. So simply giving the witness space to remember specific details will lead them to remember more and more. And then the other important mnemonics is to ask the witness to mentally reinstate context, which is a flash psychological way of saying, imagine you're back at the crime. Mm. If you start imagining what the sky was like, the smells and sounds, again, those can act as cues, and you'll find yourself remembering more important details about
the
crime.
So this is like cue-dependent leading and state-dependent memory. Is that how it's called? Where you're in that state, you're imagining you're in the place. Like people say, oh, I don't remember how to swim, but throw them in a pool, they'll probably swim.
There are many different types of memory. Your memory for how you swim or ride a bike is quite different type of memory. Psychologists call it procedural memory.
Oh, wow.
To remembering events, which is called episodic. And if you think about it, those two are very different types of memory. In a pub quiz, people often talk about, oh, he's got a or she's got an excellent memory. Mm. What they mean is they've got a very good memory for lots of very trivial pieces of information. Yeah. They don't mean that they can swim or ride a bike.
Recalling,
but swimming and riding a bike both involve memory. But yes, the idea of the cognitive interview is that the memory is cued. So the more cues that you can provide, the more likely it is that someone will remember important information.
This is going to sound really sad, so nothing better than for me to record it for everybody to hear. But every country that I travel to, when I travel for about 10 years, I used to buy some of the local deodorant. And I would only use that deodorant in the country. And for many, many years afterwards, I kept that deodorant so that when I was looking back over my snaps, I'd spray some of the deodorant. And it was phenomenal how much extra information I could remember from that trip, because every trip was relevant to, like in Italy, it was called un uomo, and it smelled horrific. But that's still out. And I remember going back to Italy and picking up a can of this, and I was getting flashbacks.
Smell is a very powerful cue for memory, and I don't want to accuse you of misremembering, but I would imagine also that although when you smell your deodorant from that country, it's suddenly a load of memories flood through. Mm. It's likely that a great deal of them maybe aren't that accurate. It's actually very hard to do is to tell the difference between your memory for something that actually happened and memory for something that didn't. So an imagination, as it were, an imagined memory.
Yeah.
And very often what you find, particularly if you're thinking back to a long time in the past, is that you will fill in gaps in your memory. Your memory is quite sparse. Yeah. You'll only remember some of the bigger events.
Because your memory wants a story?
Exactly. So your memory will construct a story of what happened. And like I say, it will fill in all the gaps. You get quite a complete, rich experience.
Yeah.
But, and this is the problem for the police, a lot of what you're remembering didn't happen and is wrong. But you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the bits that are right and the bits that aren't.
If ever I do end up talking to the police in any serious matter, is it all right if I call you in?
Certainly not, no.
Damn, I just thought you'd be great to make up lots of excuses by how that's not actually a lie. He's just remembering things differently.
Okay, but you've got to remember, if you're being called in as a witness, hopefully you wouldn't be trying to lie.
Yeah.
And if you're called in as a suspect, it's a very different matter. The type of interviewing techniques I'm talking about are used with witnesses.
Right.
So deception really isn't an issue there. You assume the person's telling the truth. I mean, the police will tell you that even using the cognitive interview, if a witness lies, and occasionally people do lie as witnesses to protect someone, and that they can still tell. But with a suspect, you use a very different type of interviewing technique called investigative interviewing. But I think it's worth saying that if you are in that unfortunate position, hopefully wrongly accused,
of course,
so you never know, in this country, you shouldn't expect to be interviewed like you see witnesses being interviewed on American television. That's called interrogation, and our police haven't used those techniques since the 1970s, very early 1980s.
Are we more advanced?
We're far more advanced, yes.
We're more advanced than American police. Are you listening to that, America?
That's not quite what I said. We're more advanced than we were in the 70s, and if you think about some of the programmes like The Sweeney, more recently, Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes, the technique of interviewing is fairly basic. You get someone in the room and you just berate them, yeah. physically threaten them. You accuse them, you're trying to trick them. So you hold back information and then right at the end you go Columbo style, oh, what about?
Yeah.
And the person's confused and they'll give in and say, oh, it's a fair cop. Mm. What you find is that that type of technique is very effective in eliciting confessions. Right. But a lot of the time, quite a bit of the time, those are false confessions.
Right. Almost mental torture. Is that too strong a term?
No. If you're physically threatening someone, I think you could count that as mental torture. In this country, we the police don't use interrogation techniques. They use investigative interviewing. So there's no threats. And one thing the police will do is right at the start of the interview, they will give you all the evidence they have. So they won't hold it back and try to trick you. They will say, we've got an eyewitness who places you at this point, outside this pub at this time of night. We have this fingerprint, we have this. And they'll set all the information out and they'll ask you to explain it. They'll say, you know, you're saying you're not guilty. Here's all the evidence. Please explain, you know, what did happen, how it is that your fingerprint was there, how this person saw you. And they'll get your side of events. There's no trickery. There's no attempt to just get a confession, regardless of, you know, whether it's right or not. So the US do tend to use interrogative techniques, like you'll see in CSI quite a bit, but that doesn't happen in this country.
So theoretically, I should just sit there and say no comment?
Well, you can say no comment, but you've got to imagine...
It's almost a statement of guilt.
You've got to imagine what that will look like. Mm. You know, we have trial by jury, and imagine yourself you're a jurist. And remember, public, you'll sit on a jury. Imagine you've got someone sitting in front of you who, through 12 hours of police interviewing, just said no comment.
Mm. So I need to hone my lying.
Well, okay, here's the thing. Yes, it's possible to hone lying, but as anyone who's seen Derren Brown programmes will know, you need to put a hell of a lot of training into it. Lying is fantastically difficult to do. It is fantastically difficult to get away with.
So is it impossible for someone to lie to you? I guess you have to be in the mindset to be actually... you can't analyse every conversation you have in a day, but if you were in the zone... and somebody started lying to you, could you tell straight away with your training and knowledge?
Okay. I don't have any training, I would say. Oh, right. It's not my own area of research. Okay. There's a great deal of research on deception, both in forensic settings and kind of more broadly, looking at verbal and non-verbal communication cues that will give you away. Mm. I would say there's no hard and fast rule. You will often see people say that, oh, you know, if the person looks up to the left or the right or they move their feet or whatever it is, they're lying. Now, that's not true. There aren't those hard and fast rules. On the other side, though, is the fact that people are actually quite bad sometimes at working out if someone's lying or not. Mm. And unfortunately, there's quite a bit of research that's found that people that say they are very good at detecting deception are no better very often than everyone else, and that does include the police. Mm. So although it's very hard to lie convincingly, the converse of that is it can be difficult to detect deception. But lying to your mother about whether you've smashed a vase or to your partner about why you're late home, you know, is one thing. But if you imagine yourself in a police interview as a suspect, they'll have done a great deal of research. They'll have scenes of crime evidence, they'll have eyewitness statements, they'll have lots and lots of information. And you'll need to be able to explain all that in a consistent way and not ever trip yourself up. Mm. And that's a very demanding thing to do. Your mind would find that a very difficult story.
Definitely. That's what I mean. My mind already is just losing stuff left, right and centre, because to a certain extent, social media and Twitter is my alibi. As soon as I throw what I'm doing out there, I tend to forget about it.
That's right. I mean, I use Outlook Calendar to basically tell me what I'm doing every second of the day. but if I don't look at it, I've got absolutely no idea.
I'm exactly the same.
I'm up to, yes.
Well, thank you so much. I am not lying when I say absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.